From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I talk with Joan Baez. She's just written a memoir about her life as a folk singer and political activist. Also today, I speak with artist Jody Pinto. Her latest work is a 59-foot bridge shaped like a human finger. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews John Gibbons' new recording of Bach's Music for Harpsichord, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg shares his insights about illiteracy in America. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is singer Joan Baez. She was at the forefront of the folk revival during the 60s and 70s. Actually, by 1958, she performed at the Newport Folk Festival when she was 18 years old. Baez began her career singing traditional ballads, like this one, Silver Dagger.
Don't sing love songs, you'll wake my mother. She's sleeping here.
Although Baez continued to sing traditional songs, she began singing more contemporary compositions, including many by her good friend Bob Dylan. Her repertoire also became very political as she took an active role in the civil rights and anti-war movements. Baez later became internationally famous for her peace activism. In 1979, she founded Humanitas International Human Rights Committee, a group she's now president of. Joan Baez has written an autobiography. It's titled And a Voice to Sing With. It's just been published by Summit Books. Joan Baez, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
And I should mention you're joining us from the NPR Chicago studio as we speak now.
That's right.
One of the things I found very amusing in your book was the realization that you were actually introduced to folk music by records of the Kingston Trio.
That was one of the introductions. And when, of course, I began singing purist songs in the purist style, etc., then I had to hide all my Kingston Trio albums at the back of the rack, although I always played them.
I thought that was great. You became a bohemian at a pretty young age. What was the appeal of that kind of lifestyle to you?
I don't know that I considered myself a bohemian. I just didn't wear shoes. And coming out of your average teenage identity crisis, not knowing who or what I was, when somebody labeled me the Madonna, I thought that was pretty hot stuff. So I bought into that and went around looking like one. And in fact, you're right, everybody was wearing black. But in the counterculture world, everybody was wearing black. And so I fell into that quite comfortably, having sort of been by nature a counterculture type, and I suppose in a way I still am.
Your repertoire when you started was filled with very, very serious and very tragic traditional folk ballads, and I know that some people in your audiences would actually laugh. You mentioned this in your book because the songs were just so serious and so sad.
Endlessly sad.
What attracted you to the material?
Pardon me?
What attracted you to that kind of material?
I think I identified with all the sort of the tragedy and so forth, and late teens, mid-teens, I was wandering around, you know, wanting to have something wonderful happen, like fall in love, and all these songs were unrequited love songs, and it was just probably one way of working out adolescence, but also they were very, very beautiful. They were long, and they were long stories, and I'd sometimes weep while I was learning them. And then the fact was that one night, sort of an awakening to me, people got the giggles in the coffee shop because it was just, there were too many sad songs in a row. And so I had to learn how to lighten up just a teensy bit.
Was that hard to do?
Well, probably for me at the beginning, yeah. I mean, people didn't know I had a sense of humor until about a week ago, you know, that I was so serious on the stage. And then, see, I got serious about politics, and I really was. And I think I was afraid that if I cracked one joke from the stage, I'd think, aha, I knew she wasn't really serious about the politics. And so I was pretty serious for a long time.
You've put together a song of cliches or very serious lines from various ballads you became famous for singing. Is there any way you would sing that for us?
Oh, in Michael?
Mm-hmm.
In the song Michael?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. There in the night with Michael, while he lay fast asleep, I put my brow to the window pane, and in the fullness of love did weep. How's that?
Okay. You've referred to your Madonna virgin image when you were starting out. What kind of image was that?
Well, you know, there was an essence of purity about all the songs that I chose and the songs that attracted me. There was an essence of purity about me, in fact. I didn't take drugs. I was, when I was labeled a virgin, I still was one. I mean, I didn't last terribly long, but and the things that attracted me in life really grew out of a Quaker background and concerns with other people struggling and with suffering, and that came down from two grandfather ministers and to my father, who had rejected defense work and lots of money to remain a Quaker and a teacher and keep his, you know, his beliefs and his integrity and so on. So there was a certain element of at least attempting to be true to ourselves in our family. And then that whole basis was the foundation for my social activism and politics all through my life. So there was an element of purity. And I think then the way that got exaggerated was my own inner and not conscious, unconscious fear of commercialism and the big world of, you know, major record companies and so on. That comes out in the book about choosing a record company. I could have had the biggest and the best and the most gold albums and so on. And I didn't go that direction. I went to something more moderate and something, a classical music company, Vanguard. And I think that I'm very, very glad for those decisions. I think they were correct. But I think underlying that was a real fear that once you step into that big wicked world, you know, you'll be swallowed up and never come out alive.
No,
which maybe has some merit, you know.
I'm thinking of all the teenage girls back in the 60s who were really dying to be you and to look like you and to sing like you. Were you aware of that, of how many people wanted to look and sound and be you?
Well, I think I was, I knew about that in a sense, but I think, again, you protect yourself from things like that because they're a little too extraordinary and they're not healthy for your equilibrium. So I think I knew more about that when I was told about it later, and I looked back on it and could see that. And of course, it's flattering, you know, it's flattering and nice in a way, but as I say, it throws you off balance.
Well, how consciously did you cultivate your image, which had such power over your listeners? By that, I mean, you know, your long hair, the kinds of colorful clothes that you'd wear.
Well, the funny thing is people established an image probably from Newport and a couple of the early pictures. And then it doesn't matter what you do, they still keep that image. I remember a woman talking to me one time. I had so much makeup on my eyes I could hardly open and close them, because that was very beatnik, is to wear gobs of stuff on your eyes but no lipstick. And the word was out that Baez didn't wear makeup. And here's this interviewer saying, and it's true, you don't wear any makeup. And I was pointing to these clots on my eyelashes. And I said, but I have makeup on. She just kept saying, that's just fascinating at your age that you reject makeup. So, you know, people see what they're ready to see in a way also. The first time somebody found out that I shopped at Magnans, it was a telephone interview with this woman, and she wanted something different. You know, what do you do for a good time? And I said, well, I love to shop. And she said, for what? And I said, clothes. And she just was dead silent. And then she said, why? And I said, because I like clothes. And she said, where do you shop? And I said, oh, you know, Saks, Magnum. And she said, why? I said, oh, because I can't get to Paris every weekend. And the poor lady, number one, she didn't know I had a sense of humor. Two, she didn't know I liked nice clothes. So it was all her title was Bias Shops at Magnum. She didn't hear anything else.
So once you've had an image that's created, it's hard for people to notice when you've changed.
Yeah, doesn't matter, you know, but there it is.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is singer and activist Joan Baez, who's written an autobiography titled A Voice to Sing With. When did you start moving your repertoire toward more contemporary and political songs?
Well, I think my courtship with ballads took maybe 2 years of my life in Cambridge in 59-60. And then as soon as I had any relationship at all with the civil rights movement, and I started that in 61, I started picking up the songs that would really be relevant in those situations. So I would start with the early songs, the spirituals, and those things could connect me with that movement. And then there was this odd situation of me being an interpretist of song. Never occurred to me to write. I probably couldn't have in those days anyway, because I was convinced I couldn't. And so that when Phil Oakes wrote There But For Fortune, and then Dylan began writing those real gems that he gave us, that's when some of my thoughts and feelings and activism connected with the music, 63, 64, 65.
You've, during your career, sung a lot of songs by Bob Dylan, who was your good friend and for a short time your lover. How did you meet?
Meet Bob. Somebody said, you've got to come to Greenwich Village. There's this incredible guy who writes music and et cetera, et cetera. And I had been told by a number of people the same thing, that this incredible guy was in the village. So I went to see him, and he was incredible. I mean, I was very impressed. He was this funny little guy with his guitar. The night I saw him, he was making up songs. He sang the song to Woody, and then he was just making up words, which just, I was in total awe of that, to just stand there and ad-lib and make up music. And then he was dragged over to the table to meet the Madonna, and it was all very awkward because, you know, I felt like some aging dowager at that point, and he seemed so young. And I didn't work with him for, I think, maybe a year or so after that. We just met him that night.
Well, you were more established than he was at the time, and you took him on an American tour that you were doing and used to introduce him.
Yeah, I'd introduce him, my audience, you know, they're trained into absolute silence to listen to the Madonna singer, nubile folk songs, and on would come this little scruff ball, and he would sing, and his voice, you know, they were not prepared for that, and then sometimes they would boo. And I'd shake my little finger at them like a schoolmarm and say, now you listen to this boy, he's a genius. And so they'd be quiet and obedient. And then before very long, maybe a verse or two, they'd figure out that in fact it was something quite astonishing going on with the songs he was writing.
Well, that really helped him get known. And then shortly thereafter, he went on an English tour and took you with him, except he didn't share the spotlight with you the way you had shared it with him.
That's true. I don't really enjoy telling Dylan stories over the air, but I would say that in what I wrote about Bob, which is, I think, has surprised people because it's very candid, I open myself up. I mean, I think you learn more about me than you do about Bob, and tell the magnificence of the music and the times that we had together and really some glorious things about him. And then it's very unflattering on the dismal parts. And that was very difficult to figure out how to write that, because that, you know, he and the other people I've dealt with in the book are important to me, were important to me. And so I think you have to write some of the good and the bad. On the other hand, I don't think a book should be written to level accounts, and I really tried not to do that. I tried to just express what those times were like.
Let's talk about this effect on you when you were touring England with him and weren't getting called onto stage and weren't sharing the spotlight with him. How did it affect you emotionally?
Well, I would talk about that in a grander sense in general. Somebody who came into an identity at age 18, as I said, you know, and I thought it was pretty terrific to be the Madonna and got lots and lots of attention and learned to sort of survive on that. And one of the things that happened was I couldn't stand having the show stolen from me. I was very ungraceful about that, and I simply couldn't believe that that was happening. About Bob's gracelessness, people can make their own assumptions why he did what he did. But the difficulty for me was my own reaction to that I kept going back to it and didn't sort of, you know, didn't use my head or didn't have one in that situation.
Do you still sing songs by him?
Sure, yeah. They're marvelous. They're the best. They're the best that anybody wrote, in my opinion, for the things that we needed and the things that we did in the 60s. They are really a gold mine.
You know, one thing that strikes me about your early career is that it was a combination of selflessness and ego. Do you know? Because you seemed on stage like a very selfless person who was pouring out her heart for the larger good, and yet you get so fed by audiences that you become very ego involved with that attention.
That's absolutely true, and I wanted to do that, you know, to present that in the book in some sort of lighthearted way. And well, it's true for those of us who have almost as our partners that audience. So when people tease or accuse me of enjoying the attention, I say, yeah. I mean, when I was 15, it's written in the book, when I was 15, we found this essay I wrote called What I Believe, and among other things it's talking about when I show off at school and I say, I'm not a saint, I'm a noise. So it was already started way back then. That's how I got my attention. We moved a lot, and I was always the new kid in the school. And though people weren't unkind to me, we always lived at the fringe. I didn't have whatever it took to sort of be instantly in the in crowd. So I was always at the edge of it. And the new kind of attention, namely people applauding and saying, "Gee whiz, you're wonderful," was I began to feed on that. And then, you know, then the part of saying that's the ego and then trying to keep my head straight or, quote, be a good person, you go back to Quaker meeting, you know, and find out, try and just keep both feet on the ground and use the entire process, people's adulation, people's response, what I do, my voice, for a common good, for something good rather than something negative.
My guest is Joan Baez. Joan, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be back in a few seconds.
Okay.
Okay. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is singer and peace activist Joan Baez. She's written an autobiography titled And a Voice to Sing With. She's joining us today from the NPR studios in Chicago. Joan, what effect did the women's movement have on you? And let me start off by asking you about a poster that you were pictured on. It was a picture of you and your sister Mimi Farina, and there was a third woman. I forget who
she
was.
She's my other sister.
And this was a poster about draft resistance, and the caption, the pictures of you three women, and the caption says, "Girls say yes to boys who say no."
Well, you know, the man I was living with, I don't know if I was married to him at that moment, was David Harris, who was on the forefront of the draft resistance movement, but on the back lines of women's consciousness. And I was in the back lines as well. When women came to the house, they were absolutely furious about that poster because it was saying, girls, first of all, say yes, second of all. You're not supposed to say yes to anybody unless, you know, you instigate the thought, to boys who say no. And my point was, you should allow yourselves to fall in love with draft resistors rather than macho men. Their point was that they didn't like anything about the poster at all, from calling us girls to saying yes to men or to boys.
Well, it made it sound like girls are more sexually available to draft resistors.
Well, just even the fact of calling us girls instead of women. I mean, I just didn't know that. I was so into, yes, I was married. That's it. I was married and I was having a wonderful time cooking bread and literally mopping up the house. I had this image of what being married was going to be all about. I think I was pregnant.
So you're trying to fit into a traditional role.
Oh, I was fitting in.
Role.
I mean, yeah. And I thought that was, I mean, in the book, it says how at one point I had these, for years, I had these fantasies of being married and there'd be children tumbling all over the floor and riding St. Bernards around and I'm cooking stew over an open fire, et cetera. Which, as it turned out, was just totally not in my script. I'm not any good at being married, no. But anyway, the first question you had about these women came to the house and were just furious about that poster. I honestly didn't know what they were talking about, and I just kept offering them sandwiches, which made them even angrier because that was being in the old-fashioned woman's role.
Well, did feminism change you at any point?
Well, I'm sure feminism has affected me, and it's affected everybody. I'm not a feminist. In the same sense, I think that during the black movement, the movement in the South, I never felt black power. And during when I worked with Cesar Chavez, I never felt brown power. I don't feel woman power. I feel people power. And I feel that that's terribly important. I can understand how people coming out of their own experiences will have a priority of their own. And for many women, that is women's consciousness. And for me, it never has been, so it would be phony to pretend it has. But it doesn't mean I can't look at it rationally, see that it's important, women's rights are important, and take my role in that, whatever it might be.
You know, I want to ask you about cutting your hair. But
you get hit the heavy stuff today.
Yeah,
huh?
No, but not
this
that
is all
kind
NPR.
Of,
I forgot.
But not in a fashion kind of way. Here's what I'm interested in. I think that you represented for so many people a kind of Earth Mother type figure, a politically active Earth Mother with long tresses, an almost goddess up there on the stage. And to me, when you cut it, it was almost saying, well, I don't have to be that, and that women don't have to be that. But I don't know if that was going through your mind at all.
Well,
maybe it was just hard to dry. I don't know.
I was pregnant. That's what happens. I mean, I think when people get pregnant, they do all sorts of wonderful new things. You know, I took two Valium and went to the hairdresser and said, get rid of this stuff. And I was a nervous wreck, but it was shedding an image. And I wanted to feel fresh and new and pregnant and all the, you know, things I hadn't been before. And I didn't give a damn about losing my hair. That was, at that point, everybody else's problem and not mine.
Yeah, but people really had a problem with it, right?
Well, there was something for them to learn then.
Did it say anything to you about what was expected of you or of your female image when you saw the reaction to cutting your hair?
Well, no, not the female image. What about the rebel? You know, how come we can see your face now and it has makeup all over it kind of thing. But really and truly, it was not my problem. I had a wonderful time with my new haircut, and I still do.
You've sung at political rallies around the world. Can you remember for us one of the times when you were on stage during a political demonstration when you really felt that the power of singing had a profound effect on the people who had gathered there?
Yeah, I can name two times right off the bat. One would be Hanoi in 1972, when I happened to be visiting Vietnamese people and delivering mail to POWs, and we got caught in a 11-day bombing raid. And this wasn't to a large audience. It was just to bomb shelters full of people. And all of us, as soon as I could sing, because I was so scared that I could barely breathe, and as soon as I could sing, I started singing, and everybody would ask for me to sing again when the bombing would get terrible. It just did something to our spirits. And another time when it really unified people, I think, was 1963, Birmingham, Alabama, at Miles College, the first integrated concert on that campus ever. I sang at a black school, because the only way I could integrate an audience was to sing on a black campus, because the blacks didn't know who I was. And so some of them would come to their own function, you know, just out of boredom. And then whites would come onto the campus, and it was absolutely terrifying because everybody was, you know, scared of a bomb going off somewhere because we were integrated. And then at the end of that concert, everybody stood up and sang "We Shall Overcome," and that is including rednecks and people who claimed that they just came because they were reporters. And we all were crying and we all were singing, and it really was a mighty day.
When the folk revival died down, did you feel like your audience had deserted you?
Well, you know, it's 1980 what now? 87.
Seven.
Yes. No, I have this marvelous audience that stays with me. Now, that's different in different countries. In Europe, say Latin America, probably Africa, Spain, and so on, my audiences are much younger, and I'm not sure why. I think it has to do with political atmosphere and social atmosphere, and they're deeper rooted and broader and can accept a wider range of things. And they're not as faddish as we are in the States. But it's an extraordinary phenomenon for me to be able to go on singing and recruiting people who are, in fact, interested in somebody who sings melody, sings words, will deal with topics of the time. I'm a little easier now because I do have a sense of humor on the stage. You know, but that, of course, things change. You know, it's been 28 years, and things are bound to change. Not only change, but they changed about 180 degrees from long contemplative ballads and introspection and small is beautiful and earth music to cosmos, the beat, no emphasis on words, It's been a huge change, and I've had to simply forge my way through that. And as you may or may not know, there'd been an 8-year break between records, and I now finally have one with which I am ecstatically happy, because it just seemed to take that time for the right company, for me to find the right company and us to work together and make music.
For years, you were a symbol of the youth movement, the youth counterculture, the youth political movement. Was it hard for you to accept being older after years of symbolizing young activism?
Well, you can leave off the second half of that sentence. Everybody has to deal with the years as they pass. One of the things that was very helpful to me, and I think I suspected that would happen in writing this book, it took 3 years. I started it 3 years ago. I'm looking for patience. You know, I'm looking for my way of dealing with not only the next 45 years, but now. I hope at the end of the chapter on Martin Luther King, I express how jealous I am of him when he said, "I've been to the mountaintop and I've seen the promised land." What he was saying was number one, I'm not afraid of death anymore. Number two, I know exactly what I'm doing. Well, I would like to not be afraid of death or middle age or being older than middle age, etc. I'd like to not be preoccupied with all that. I would like to find, how do I do God's will and do it the best and share myself intelligently with the rest of the human race until I die? And so those are things that I was trying to work out through writing the book and a little bit through making the album.
You took voice lessons not too long ago. I don't know if you're still taking them.
Yeah, I'll have to take them until I stop singing now.
What has the voice lessons taught you about your voice and your singing?
Well, they taught me that I had a natural talent from probably age 13, and that when you're young, you're elastic and everything works and you don't have to do much about it, you know, Becker. And then that when I went to see this man, it took me 4 years to get to a voice coach because it didn't dawn on me that coughing and hacking and having trouble with high notes was a reality. And when it finally it dawned on me, I went to get help, and this man said something very funny. He said, didn't anybody ever tell you that when you get around 40, gravity takes over everything? And I said, oh, thanks a lot, Charlie. But he said, if you really want those pipes to be in terrific condition, you'll have to work with them every day of your life, with a few exceptions from now until you quit singing. So when I accepted that and began working with it, we've really changed the whole structure of throat and chest and breathing and all those things I'd never thought about. And it's been, I really consider my voice to be in its second prime.
It's changed the mechanics of your singing. Do you think it's changed the sound of your voice?
Well, it has some, but the sound of your voice changes anyway. It deepens. And so what's happened is that though I would never be able to sing the high, high Barbara Allen in that very light soprano again, I can sing it in a different soprano, and I can sing in a much richer lower voice and have more fun with it because I feel more secure.
Okay, well, Joan Baez, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
My guest has been singer Joan Baez, and she's written an autobiography titled And a Voice to Sing With. It's just been published by Summit Books. She has a new record titled Recently that will be released next week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next program, I'll talk with sports writer Michael Bamberger about his experiences as a caddy on the professional golf tour, and that's the subject of his new book, so I hope you can join us. This is an excerpt of Joan Baez's new recording.
Recently, they all came back to me. Somebody promised us roses. We slid by. Today I see it's only a memory. A decade ago, it vanished from sight with the speed of a shooting star, leaving you, leaving me where we are. Well, you could say it's
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, artist Jody Pinto talks about her work. Her new piece is a pedestrian bridge shaped like a human finger. Also, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Bach's music for harpsichord performed by John Gibbons. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the problem of illiteracy in America, and we'll get the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Here's the news. This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has a review of a new album by John Gibbons. Gibbons is harpsichordist in residence of the Musical Instruments Collection at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. He's also a member of the Boston Museum Trio. His new recording is called A Bach Recital.
2 years ago, at the Boston Early Music Festival, harpsichordist John Gibbons saved an awful evening from complete disaster. Around 11 p.m., with still another long act to go in a phony Baroque performance of a second-rate Handel opera, Gibbons played a Handel harpsichord concerto, just like Handel himself is supposed to have done in 1713. He did a brilliant job, with music better than the music in the opera, and with a warmth and humanity that surpassed most of the singers in the cast. At this year's festival, Gibbons gave his own concert at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts, and it was one of the major events of the season. Nonesuch has just released his new Bach album, and once again he reveals himself to be a performer of uncommon sensitivity and imagination. In his program notes for the recording, Gibbons writes about the problems of playing the harpsichord. Certain basic techniques are antithetical to this instrument. There's no direct way, for example, to control volume. Textures can be thicker or thinner, but there are no real crescendos or diminuendos, louder and softer. That's why the forte piano and the pianoforte had to be invented. Gibbons remembers from his own student days an older musician pointing to the score he was studying and telling him, "The black is the notes, the white is the music." If, as he says, the harpsichord is perfectly designed to play the black, Gibbons's mastery of the instrument can be measured by how well he's learned to play the white, to give the harpsichord what he calls the curve and swell of melody, the singing voice it wasn't born with. And this new Bach record is his most important achievement. The greatest work on this album is surely the powerful Chromatic Fantasy and Fugue, a piece you don't hear too often in recitals. This is the piece that may tell us most about what Bach himself was like as a performer. The fantasy, perhaps unique in Bach, sounds like a complex improvisation. The classic version is the one Wanda Landowska recorded in 1935 on her gigantic 1912 Pleyel. Her expansive performance, in a style we'd consider more romantic than she would have, has the drama and density of a novel. Gibbons, more in tune with what we now consider authentic Baroque style, gives us less a novel than a poem, luminous, intricate, and deeply touching in its emotional directness. And the wonderful flow of details builds to a tremendous climax. John Gibbons playing Bach. A further sign of his seriousness are the other works he chooses for this new album. Major, ambitious works like the big Prelude and Fugue in A minor and the challenging C minor fantasy. Since Bach never completed the fugue, Gibbons here combines the fantasy with the great three-voice ricercata from Bach's musical offering, a work for which Bach never specified any instrumentation. But perhaps the other gem on the album is the haunting Capriccio in B-flat major, the so-called Capriccio on the Departure of His Most Beloved Brother, with its poignantly slow Adagissimo aria of farewell and its final fugue imitating the Postillion's horn. Gibbons, quoting pianist Arthur Schnabel, modestly refers to all of these as music better than it can be performed. His recording might be more accurately called music better than it's been performed in a long time.
Lloyd Schwartz is a classical music editor at the Boston Phoenix. He's a poet and teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed John Gibbons' new album, A Bach Recital. This is Fresh Air. My guest is artist Jody Pinto. Over the years, she's been commissioned to construct many temporary installations that are made just for a specific outdoor site. Her structures often use parts of the body as the architectural form. Her works have such titles as Split Tongue Pier, Hospitable Structures for the Wounded Body, Monumental Chamber for an Amputated Finger, and A Cave for a Split Tongue. Her work has also been exhibited at the Whitney Museum, the Los Angeles Institute of Contemporary Art, the Virginia Museum, and the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia. Her latest work is called Fingerspan, and it was commissioned by the Fairmount Park Art Association in Philadelphia. She started the project 7 years ago, and it was installed in the park just a few days ago. I asked Jody Pinto to describe Fingerspan.
It's a bridge that's in the shape of a bent finger, and it's made out of Corten steel or weathering steel. It spans a gully along the Wissahickon Creek in Fairmount Park in Philadelphia. And basically, it's a steel structure with a perforated skin that you walk through that covers the support inside the bridge. And the bridge itself looks like an armored finger through which pedestrians walk that are hiking on the trail.
The bridge just seems to be a little bit steeper than necessary. Did you want to remind us of the dangers of travel?
Yes, the whole purpose of making the finger a crooked finger, a bent finger, was to continue the hiker's climb, in a sense, and experience of climbing a nature trail. Most bridges are straight spans, and I wanted to continue the experience of climbing. The people that walk through that finger are, in a sense, the muscle and the marrow of the finger.
Are you making connections between body parts and architecture?
Yes, yes. In the same way that you could consider a corridor a part of a building or a passageway. Most of the sculpture deals with physical passage through a fragment that enables the actor or the pedestrian to understand more about their own bodies in relation to their surroundings.
Any body part out of context gives the sense of amputation. Is that the kind of sense that you want to give when you're using body parts as sculptural form?
No. You know, when we think very often of a single finger or a heart, let's say, which is also imagery that I've used, or a tongue, a split tongue for a pier, for me, it comes from, I would say, a background that involves Catholicism. And in a sense, Catholicism used parts of the body to signify the power of the entire body, or to signify a spirituality. And when I use these single fragments, I'm doing the same thing. I'm signifying the entire experience of the body.
Are there mysterious or frightening images you were exposed to as a child that you think are that you think you're drawing on in your art now?
Yes. Well, I think my early upbringing. I went to a French convent school, and I would say that a lot of the imagery that I became familiar with was actually, for me, exciting. I found it very mysterious. Now, maybe that's because my background family life was one of storytelling, and so at a very early age, I was encouraged to enjoy mystery rather than being frightened of it. And certainly that helped my imagination to grow and my work as an artist.
I think it was in the early 1970s that you co-founded the Philadelphia chapter of Women Organized Against Rape, which is basically a group to prevent the violation of the body. And I wonder if that connects at all with the work that you're doing, especially given the emphasis on body parts in your work.
I think that's a very good point. I have a tremendous reverence for the body and respect, and it's my feeling that we grow from the time we're born through information that we gather through the body, that the body is the central source of all information. And as an artist as well, then my respect is even greater for the body, because that is, after all, the vehicle for creating and for me, for building. So my work in founding Women Organized Against Rape was an affirmation of the self-determination of the body and a person's right over their own body.
The Fingerspan Bridge is probably the most permanent and the most utilitarian work that you've ever done. Is that right?
Yes. It's the first major permanent work that I've done. And actually, that was one of the exciting premises of the project. The sculpture had to be functional, and so a site was selected, and then I dealt with all the problems of building a bridge in a remote area in a park in contemporary times. You know, how do you make it safe? How do you keep the integrity of the artist's original design and idea? How do you make it more or less vandal-proof? And how do you also make it maintenance-free? And it seems to me that Fingerspan answered all of those problems very well.
Now, you talked about safety concerns in the construction of the bridge, and that works a number of ways. There's the concern that maybe the bridge would fall, and I know I know you took care of that
No.
But there's also the safety concern of being, you know, alone in the woods on a remote path. And I wonder what your thoughts were like about that, especially as a founder of Women Organized Against Rape. I know you're very aware of dangers to women alone in remote locations.
Yes. Well, as far as safety goes, the problem with any structure in a remote area, but maybe particularly a bridge or a span, was how do you introduce a bridge over a gully and not completely cover it, because in covering it, it either turns into a pissoir very, very shortly, or passers-through can't be seen. So the problem was, how do you design a covering for the bridge, which it absolutely had to have? So my idea was to use a perforated skin for the bridge, also made out of Corten steel. And essentially what that is almost a kind of screen covering. But because it's made out of steel, it's very strong. It can't be pushed through. But at the same time, passers-through can see all around them as they walk through the bridge. they can also see below them because the footpath of the bridge is grating, steel grating. So the entire structure, while you're walking through, is an experience of linear structure and light.
It's a very narrow path that leads to the bridge. And
yes.
as you described it, it's right over a gully.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really trying to imagine what it was like the day the bridge was installed, when the helicopters lowered in the parts. Could you describe what that was like?
Yes. I was standing there, and I was shading my eyes and looking up and watching this helicopter slowly lift this piece. It had taken 7 years to get to this point, and I'm shading my eyes, and I'm looking up, and people are cheering, and I'm thinking to myself, because the sun had come out, this must be sweat running down my face. And once the helicopter had taken off and had passed over the trees, someone pushed a microphone in my face and said, "How does it feel? How does it feel?" And I realized I was crying. It was very dramatic and very moving.
Were you the first person to walk through it?
You bet I was. Yes, yes. And for 7 years, I'd been drawing sketches of Fingerspan and seeing it. I knew what it would look like when it was there in the park. And when I walked through the bridge for that first time, it was like walking through my imagination.
Jody Pinto, I want to thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jody Pinto's bridge, Fingerspan, is in Fairmount Park in Philadelphia. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Well, President Reagan has chosen his nominee for the Supreme Court.
That's right. Robert Bork, the appellate judge, known to some as the Solicitor General during what was called the Saturday Night Massacre back during Watergate days, is President Reagan's nominee to fill the Powell vacancy on the Supreme Court. And we'll have a report on that from Nina Totenberg, and also a report on congressional reaction. Will this nomination sail through without any problems or not?
What else are you covering?
Also, events in South Korea, President Chun Doo-hwan's acceptance of democratic reforms, and a report on what those reforms might mean for U.S.-South Korean economic ties.
Well, thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, has been thinking about what it means to be illiterate in America. He says the usual definition of illiteracy doesn't go far enough.
You hear a lot about illiterates these days, usually in the context of discussions of what we are in danger of becoming a nation of. Politicians and educators are warning us that we can't afford to become a nation of computer illiterates or scientific illiterates. And E.D. Hirsch has written a bestseller telling us that we can't afford to become a nation of cultural illiterates, by which he means people who don't know who Gertrude Stein or Jean-Paul Sartre were. In a recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, Professor Paul Woodring suggests that this talk is all nonsense. As he puts it, any sixth grader should be able to tell these people that illiteracy means the inability to read or write. According to that traditional definition, he suggests, almost all Americans are literate. We may have a problem with ignorance, but not with illiteracy. Now, it's true that we want to make sure that the word illiterate doesn't wind up becoming only a euphemism for ignoramus. But like most of the things that every sixth grader knows, the traditional common sense definition of illiteracy is dangerously oversimplified. It's a big mistake to think that you can talk about the ability to read and write as if that skill were separate from other kinds of knowledge. The fact is that you can be an honors graduate of Sesame Street and still be quite helpless in modern society. As an exercise, stop for a moment and consider all of the different kinds of written text you had to read today. I don't mean just newspapers or books. I mean every separate chunk of writing that you had to decode. Let's say you drove to the office this morning. How many signs did you have to read? Don't forget billboards, street numbers, bumper stickers, vanity plates, or the logos on the exotic cars you passed. Did you look at the titles of your cassette tapes or read the radio dial? Did you stop for gas? In that case, you had to read the sign at the gas station and then read the signs that directed you to the self-serve pump. Then you had to read the instructions on the pumps, read the amount of your purchase, and read the bills in your wallet to pay for it. Remember, this is America, where all bills come in the same size and color. And don't forget to read your change. And so on for the rest of the day, with texts assaulting you on every side, on parking meters, on the elevator floor indicators, on the lunch menu, on the copy machine instruction card. It's no wonder we come home exhausted and flip on the TV to Wheel of Fortune. Now, to accomplish even the simplest of these tasks, you've got to know about gas stations, highways, and computers, and how the written word is used in each of those contexts. And if you're trying to make sense of a newspaper, it isn't enough to be able to sound out words like Persian Gulf or Court of Appeals. You have to know something about the things those words refer to. In a sense, Professor Woodring's right. The word literacy really doesn't do justice to the complicated skills that we've been talking about. For just that reason, most scholars nowadays prefer to talk about functional literacy instead. When the Department of Education estimates that 27 million Americans are functionally illiterate, they mean that 27 million Americans can't function in a literate society. Most of these people would count as literate in the traditional sense. In the abstract, they can read or write just fine. But they can't deal with an automated teller or fill out a credit application, and they can't understand a simple newspaper story about the Iran-Contra affair. Despite Professor Woodring's reassurances, then, it's quite clear that functional illiteracy is a real problem in America. And part of the solution is realizing that literacy is not the simple, basic skill that every sixth grader thinks it is.
Our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's a look at our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with comic Graham Chapman. He's a founding member of the British comedy group Monty Python's Flying Circus. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Whitney, the second album by pop singer Whitney Houston, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Full Metal Jacket, Stanley Kubrick's new film about the Vietnam War. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Bergen directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.